Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Health Care and Veterans Affairs to order. It is Tuesday. How time flies. April 7th, 2009.
I think it's Friday. Aren't we going home?
No. So, just to let you know the order, we may be passing three of the health bills out at the end of today, this morning, if we can. If not, we will be doing it this evening. So, with that, I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 316. And Senator Devlin, do you want to come forward and you want to let us know where we are with that bill, Mr. Shook?
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 316 requires a health benefit plan to provide coverage of routine cost of care and qualifying clinical trials subject to copayment and other cost-sharing requirements. This was heard about a month ago. There was a work group and a couple of amendments, both -2 of which are in your packet. We do have a fiscal -2 and a revenue -2 on this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for allowing me to come and speak again in support of SB 316 and the -2 amendments. While it has been a while since the bill has been heard in committee, the advocates are glad to be back and believe all the kinks have been worked out of the bill. I would like to thank the chair, and I would like to thank the two committee members, Senator Bates and Senator Cruz, who worked very diligently on the work group to come up with a compromise with all of the parties, and I believe that the compromise is one that will work both for all the parties that are involved from the healthcare side and from the people that are actually in the clinical trials and need the care. The -2 amendments clarify the definition of routine care. They define what is and what isn't a qualifying clinical trial. They remove requirements of non-participating providers, which was actually a drafting error in the original bill, and they add back in the sunset provision to the bill. It is my understanding that the insurance companies are comfortable with the -2 amend language, and so are the advocates. No one expects any significant increased cost. This is a very good bill. It will clearly provide some solace to those people that are going through clinical trials that their routine care will be covered under their health insurance policies and that they will be in a situation that where they won't be deprived of the opportunity to participate in a clinical trial simply because they would not have the routine care that they would normally have under their insurance policies. Very good bill as amended by the -2 amendments. I would urge your passage.
Thank you. And for the record, in reading the fiscal, let's get it on the record that the Department of Consumer and Business Services said that the bill has a minimal fiscal impact on our high-risk pool, the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, because they don't really know how many would take advantage of these clinical trials, but they said it would be likely be no rate impact on the passage of this bill. Is there any other discussion? We're in work session.
Madam Chair, I'd move the -2 amendments into Senate Bill 316.
Senator Bates moves the -2s into Senate Bill 316. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Are we ready to move the bill itself? Madam Chair, I'd move that Senate Bill 316 be sent to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Bates moves Senate Bill 316 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. And Senator Devlin, would you like to carry the bill?
Thank you.
With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 316, and I'd like to open a public hearing on 734. Mr. Shook.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 734 requires certain health insurers to cover tobacco use cessation programs. This is the first time we've heard this bill, public hearing on this bill.
Okay, and this is sponsored by Senator Morissette. Do you want to talk?
There are some.
Okay. All right, Dr. Chuck Benz and Russ Spencer from Pfizer.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Russ Spencer. I represent Pfizer, researcher, manufacturer, and marketer of medicines and cures. I'm here in two capacities to support this very important bill. First, on behalf of Pfizer, we do support this bill. I'll be very candid. We have a drug that treats smoking cessation. We have a financial interest in it. It's pretty obvious and transparent, and we think this is a good thing. I'm also here on my own behalf. And I'm here, and I'm going to be brief because I think Dr. Benz is frankly, is a nationally recognized expert on smoking cessation and can give you more of the information you need. I'm here kind of to put a little bit of a personal face on this. Like many of you, I'm sure I've had family members that have died as a direct result from smoking. When I was 20 years old, my mother was diagnosed with lung cancer. 6 months later, she died. And this was at a time when we didn't have hospice care. We didn't have a lot of the palliative treatments that were available now. And so we tried to keep her home and comfortable as long as we could. And she was taking such high levels of morphine injections that we had to administer that we had a visit from a drug enforcement agency agent to come and see if, in fact, we really did have somebody that was terminally ill in the house. The devastation, as you can imagine, she left behind a husband and three sons. About 7 years later, my father died of a massive stroke, which the doctors decided was directly attributable to his heavy smoking. I found him passed out on the floor of his apartment in a coma. He never regained consciousness and left behind. Now, I have four children, so four grandchildren, which we barely had opportunity to know. And a very close friend of mine had her mother, who was somebody like a second mother to me, also passed away from lung cancer, and the family was unable just emotionally to be there for her at the end. So I sat in her hospital room and I held her hand as she died. So that's three lives that I've sadly sat in Good Samaritan Hospital holding hands and watching people slip away. It's a devastating, devastating illness. I think that's intuitively obvious to all of us. We know that. This bill offers an opportunity to have a very real impact on this type of devastation and help people go away. My parents, I can remember as a child watching, literally these were the days of cold turkey. They literally tried to quit cold turkey. It almost seems like voodoo at this point to look back on that and think that was recognized as a legitimate treatment methodology. Now we're in a new generation. We have new generations of drugs that are incredibly effective, and they work, and they're available if we can get them to people. And if we can get them to people, we'll take advantage of them, and we'll save lives. In a nutshell, I think you have an opportunity this morning to move along a bill that you can walk out of here at the end of the session and know beyond a shadow of a doubt that you will save lives, extended lives, and you will make sure that other families don't have to go through the turmoil that we had to go through and that I'm sure many of you have had to go through. It's such a pervasive disease. With that, I'm going to stop here and defer to Dr. Benz, who I think can give you much more of the really concrete nuts and bolts information you need. I'd be happy to answer questions if you have. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony also.
Thank you.
My name is Chuck Benz. It's a pleasure to speak with you this morning. I took time out of a busy practice to come down here just because this is one of the things that I've found. It's the most important thing that I do as a doctor. I've been in practice 20 years, internal medicine, in Portland. I spent 15 years as the medical director for the tobacco cessation and prevention program for Providence Health System for the whole state. And some of my background, I studied and did research at Kaiser Permanente and helped evaluate the efforts of Kaiser to do tobacco cessation, and they've been doing this since the 60s. They immediately found when they decided to do managed care that one of the most important things they could do was to help patients quit. And so they've had a strong focus on cessation and prevention. When I joined Providence, we weren't doing anything with tobacco cessation. Over my 15 years there, we created one of the premier tobacco cessation programs in the country. My last year there, 2007, our inpatient program, we identified and intervened with over 10,000 hospitalized smokers in our three Portland hospitals. It's the largest inpatient cessation program of its kind in the world. And so we intervened. You know, someone who would get admitted to St. Vincent's or Providence or Milwaukee, they would be asked about smoking, and then we would identify them. We'd print out who they were, and we would have someone go up and intervene with them right at the bedside. And we had fully 10,000 hospitalized smokers intervened with. And once they got out of the hospital, they were quit. The problem was that only a third of them could continue with their cessation. Most of them relapse because they don't have a benefit. I work with the Tobacco Free Coalition for a number of years trying to get health systems to step up to the plate and cover tobacco cessation. It's the most important thing that health systems can do. There's nothing more important. There's nothing that decreases cardiac risk, lung cancer risk, all kinds of cancer. The most important thing, and the Surgeon General came out with this many times, there have been over 29 Surgeon General reports that talk about the dangers of smoking since the 60s. And yet here in Oregon, only about a third of the programs, third of the health insurance carriers cover cessation in a comprehensive fashion. And so one of the things that I've dedicated my life to is to taking care of patients and to improving health. I brought in almost $1 million in tobacco cessation research. I've been designated by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the CDC, the American Cancer Society as having the premier tobacco cessation system in the country. And the problem that I face is not what we do as physicians and not what we do as health systems. The problem I face is getting the benefits to get these programs covered. We know they work. We know that they're effective. What we need is we need people to be able to say, I need this, and it's covered by their insurance. It's a no-brainer. And after working for over a decade here in Oregon, trying to get health systems to step up, they just wouldn't. So what we did is we decided, well, let's go out to the purchasers. So we created something called the Make It Your Business campaign, where we would go to a company and say, listen, you know, you can actually save money. On average, you can save over $3,000 per smoker if you can get them to quit. And that's in better productivity and less health care costs. $3,000 for every smoker you have in your employ, you can save. And we took that out to the businesses, and some of the businesses saw the light, and they added a rider, you know, to cover this. The problem is, even with that, we're still less than half of the insured lives in our state have a cessation benefit. And actually, when I saw this bill, I've been looking forward to this bill in my professional life for a long time, and even this bill doesn't go far enough, in my opinion, because it's a one-lifetime benefit. We all know that smoking is a lifelong habit. We've all heard about people who have, you know, smoked and then they quit, but then 5 years later they go through stress and they relapse again. The reason is because smoking causes a chronic condition in the brain where you have these receptors for nicotine and you're always at risk for relapse. And if you had high blood pressure, would you just give one prescription for blood pressure medicine and then be done? Or if you had diabetes, would you give a year's worth of insulin? When people have a tobacco addiction, it's a lifelong addiction, and it needs lifelong therapy, because there are going to be times when you're, you know, in relapse, and there are going to be times when you're abstinent. And it's a medical condition. It's not just a choice. Tobacco use was a choice when you were a teenager. But after the 100th cigarette, you've already got this process of addiction. And by the time we're dealing with people who are aware enough to decide to quit, they can't. And so this bill is really important, and it's the most important thing that I can think of, and it's why I'm here this morning. And I just would be happy to answer any questions.
I noticed that this is for children 15 or older, and yet the data does show that approximately 3,000 kids under the age of 18 start smoking, and the age when children start smoking averages between 13 and 17. I know adults who said they started when they were actually age 8. Mm. There's probably a reason why this is for 15 and older only.
There's a really good reason for that. Number one, the FDA really doesn't have a whole lot that's approved underneath, and so we want to go with helping people quit. You bring up a really important point about stopping people from starting in the first place. And again, health care and health insurance is great for treating. We really need we need changes in access. We need a higher tobacco tax so that it's hard for people to start smoking. I'm not talking, whatever you guys want to do with the money, feel free. Getting the tobacco tax increased is a great public health I don't want to, this isn't, we're not talking about tobacco tax here, I understand that, but what it does is it's there's two populations that are really susceptible to that, kids and minorities. If you raise the price, people don't smoke as much. They just and they don't start. So it's really important. There are a bunch of other things to do in the school. There are a bunch of other things to do in the media. There are a bunch of other things to do with public smoking and making public statements and preventing denormalizing it. The Truth Campaign, which American Legacy Foundation has done. And again, prevention is a whole issue that we could spend a lot of time talking about. What we're talking about here is treating the addiction. Health care and health insurances treat medical problems, and this is the most important medical problem that I face. If we didn't have tobacco, the VA would be empty. Well, half, probably. My practice would be light. I'd be taking care of a lot of other things, and I'd like to do that. I'd like to have a practice like that.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator.
You mentioned that this bill doesn't go far enough. This is a one-time...
It's a lifetime benefit, and it's a start. Now, let me tell you, this is a great bill. Yeah. But in my opinion, there needs to be, if there needs to be a continual every year. If you quit, great, but then, you know, what happens 5 years from now? If you're still in the same plan, you need to have the same thing again. Because these medicines, these programs will help people quit. And it's a great start, and I urge you with just everything that I can say to pass this particular bill.
Okay, now let me get this straight. This bill will allow a person to get the treatment to quit smoking, and if they come back in 2 years, are they covered?
There's a dollar amount here, and many, yeah, like the insurance companies that I've talked with, for example, the program that I helped establish with Providence, it actually, they do more. They have a lot of, if you have, they have unlimited amount in Providence, and I think Kaiser Permanente as well. If you're a member of those two companies, health insurance plan, you know, you'll have continually year after year. What we're talking about is we're talking about the half of the insurance companies in the state right now that do not offer cessation as a standard benefit. Getting them to at least do it once is a quantum leap forward.
Okay.
This would not interfere with what the other, I would call, health systems and health insurance plans that are already, they've already stepped up.
Now, I talked to a couple of insurers, and there's no one in opposition. I assume, and I see insurers out there, that they didn't sign up. So has anyone come forward that was
Madam
strong
Chair,
opposition?
No one has expressed any direct opposition to me. I would also, if I may add, and I was remiss in this, for the record, this bill is also supported by the American Cancer Society of Oregon, the American Lung Association of Oregon, the American Heart Association, Pacific Mountain Affiliate, the March of Dimes, Greater Portland, Oregon Chapter, and the American Diabetes Association of Oregon in Southwest Washington.
And it's a pill?
Madam Chairman, I'll defer to Dr. Benz. What we make is a pill, but this goes far beyond any single medicine.
The Public Health Service for the United States has come out with a rather intensive, comprehensive guideline for what really helps people quit. And there are over 8,000 randomized clinical trials that have gone into this. And it talks about medications, some of which are pills, some of which are the patch, some of which are, inhalers and gums and all sorts of things for the medicines. But it's not just the medicine here. Medicine's only half the picture. The other half is learning to become an ex-smoker. The classes, the counseling, including addressing tobacco as part of every single disease management. If you have heart disease, you shouldn't always only lower your cholesterol, but you should also quit smoking and how we can help with that. So it's the comprehensive package of behavioral changes, system changes, medication, coverage, and benefit. And this kind of a bill will allow, actually, it'll tell insurances what they need to be doing, and they know this. That's why you won't see a health insurance company come up here and say, well, we can't do this. It's the most important thing for health benefit. For pregnant women who smoke, I mean, there's nothing more important to decrease SIDS, to decrease low birth weight, to decrease complications, to decrease neonatal intensive care units. I mean, there's nobody in the right mind who would actually want to come up and say, oh, no, we don't want to do this. If they have the word health in their title, they can't be against this bill.
I taught smoking cessation classes at Oregon City High School when I was a clinic nurse there. I think they came to my classes mainly because they wanted to get out of class. But I'm not sure how great my success rate was. But I think that there's a whole lot more options available, and I like this comprehensive approach. Yeah, Dr. Bates. Whenever we're medical, I go to Dr. Bates then Senator Morse.
Dr. Benz, thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Benz, I appreciate your testimony this morning. You, like I, probably see half our patients are there as a result of smoking, either from lung disease, heart disease, bladder cancer. We can go on and on and on. My practice probably 50% of what it is now, and that'd be fine with me. I'll go fly fishing, okay? And I think the public doesn't realize the intensity and severity of disease as a result of smoking. I mean, it's just overwhelming in our practices, and we see it every day. I would guess that 75% of my patients in my practice smoke versus 25% of the public, and I would guess most primary care physicians are the same statistics of about that number. Would you agree, Dr. Benz?
Yeah, I think that the smoking rate varies by demographics. Some of the more rural, some of the underserved, much higher smoking rates, up to half. If you have a college-educated, predominantly high income, it's lower rates. But regardless of who it is, the smoking cessation programs work.
Right. And what I'd like to point out is that I've been doing this for 30 years, as you have. It's been very difficult to get people to quit smoking. It takes sort of a holistic approach to it. You have to counsel them and get them in counseling programs sometimes. But there has been a major breakthrough in the last few years, at least it is in my practice. And I want to find out, Russ, you may want to answer this one. We've had Zyban and Wellbutrin and nicotine patches and various drugs in the past that have helped our patients quit smoking. But Chantix really is a different drug. It has been a huge breakthrough, at least in my practice. I think my cessation rate, as near as we can track it, and we haven't got an electronic medical record yet. We're getting it put in. But we're looking at rates around 60%, we believe, of quitting. And that's probably twice as high as anything we've had before. So this bill, for me, is really important because so many of my patients, Chantix is not covered by their insurer. And I think the insurance companies just haven't quite got a chance to catch up to this. When other drugs came out, they were promised to do a great deal for smoking cessation. They were somewhat helpful. This is a real breakthrough. This drug is markedly different in what it does for people. People really do quit when they start taking this, and that's why I think it's extremely important that this gets passed. And Russ, you maybe will give us some numbers on this, or Dr. Benz, you can.
I actually probably have prescribed more Chantix than anybody in the state. As a medical director of a tobacco program, we had a class where people could come to the cessation class, and medications were provided at no cost. So you didn't actually have to get a prescription. You could, if you showed up to the class, you would get the medicine. You could get whatever medicine you wanted. And I've been doing this class now for a decade, and we had pretty good quit rates. But when we added the varenicline, the Chantix, our quit rates just soared. They just did a whole level up. And it's been the most incredibly effective, newest medication intervention that I've seen. And I've been doing tobacco cessation research for 20 years. And to see this, it's been remarkable. And people are starting to know this. And they want to give it a try, and they're interested. But like your practice, I probably have only maybe less than a quarter of my patients have it covered. And so the problem is not do we have medicines or can we help people quit. The problem is getting it covered.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You bet. Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My first question has been answered. Thank you, Dr. Bates. The issue is, and the estimate is 10 cents per member per month. Is that a pretty reliable estimate?
It's a pretty good estimate, that actually, to answer your question. It's been looked at. And again, when you talk about this with people who purchase health care, they say, golly, for this, we can actually save $3,000. So there's a, if for an employer, and in looking at and those things, so you have to take the cost of the premium because it's an added benefit. And a lot of people are talking about how do we save costs? Is this the right time? All that. The thing is, this is the time where we need to take a look at what we are covering and make sure that we're covering the right thing. There's nothing more important than cessation, and rather than covering some of these other things, we need to cover this. And this is a time when, if we're talking about this, but there is, any time you add something to a medical coverage, it will increase that. And yet, there are decisions to be made here. And so the increase, is this something that maybe they should maybe not cover? This is more important, and it's a matter of just making a decision here. And if you talk to any physician or any nurse, or anybody who's been at the bedside of someone who's gone through this, there's going to be no doubt about what's important here. But you are correct. There is, and it's probably less than that, a little less than that. But, I mean, I think 10 cents is a reasonable, probably estimate for what we're talking about.
Senator Bates?
I'm done. Thank you.
Follow up on that question. One of the things that concerns me about health care and the cost of health care is we do things that are preventative, and there's huge cost savings to the system overall. But it's downstream. You get somebody to quit smoking or prevent them from smoking in their teen years or 20s or 30s, the value of that is often not seen until their 60s and 70s. And so the insurers are asked to pick up the cost up front of very important preventative care. But in the model they have to work under, they don't reap the benefit of that. Medicare does, or a different insurer does. And I think something like this sort of levels the playing field so that everyone has to pay in. The company has stepped up and says, yeah, we'll cover it, knowing there's no real benefit to our product line, is doing the right thing, and it levels it for everybody. I would guess if you did a cost analysis of this, it would be huge. The gain would be huge, but you might not see it until the Medicare program kicks in for that particular patient or close to that time.
You're going to see this benefit, and I would agree with that completely, even with the patient and the cost that they save in cigarettes. And the benefit to the patient and being able to spend it on other things, there's some economic benefits that'll be true.
But they're not direct to the insurer that has to pay the cost up front. And I appreciate their position on this. I think it levels the playing field, gets everybody in the game, and it makes it a fair level playing field and doing the right thing long term.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Marcet.
The reason I was willing to chief response to this bill, there are two reasons. One, that the state kind of backed out of the cessation program in the 90s, late 90s, into the 2001. Secondly, my wife, we have 8 living children. 3 of them were premature and died. And when she changed doctors, we moved to Eugene from Portland, the doctor said, I won't treat you unless you quit smoking. And she did. So the last 2 children are full term and full weight.
Yeah. And Senator Cruz.
Doctor, you brought up a really good point as to looking at,
let's see,
what we are mandating and making discrete decisions. Historically, all we do is add mandates. We never look at prioritization as to if we add this, what can we remove to keep costs neutral, and we never look at that. And I think that's an interesting concept and something we might want to pursue. I'm not saying this is bad, but that's clearly an issue. And the other issue is we're looking at adding more insurance mandates at the same time we're considering a premium tax. And so, we tend to look at these things as isolated entities done to themselves without looking at the full scope. And I think it might behoove us to take a look at some of the other mandates and making discrete decisions at some point in time.
Madam Chair.
Senator Marcet.
It's kind of interesting because we have a limited healthcare system. We have pre-existing conditions that we do not cover. We have prescriptions that have a high copay that some insurance companies do not cover. insurance companies do not provide health care. Sometimes they stand in the way of health care being provided. And to me, it's very frustrating. I think a mandate is a right that people have to health care. It's a basic human right that people have. And hopefully at some point we will have a program that has a large enough pool so all people can be in the pool and everyone can be covered. Now, that doesn't mean that insurance companies will go away. There's a role for insurance companies. People can spend up, they can do all kinds of things, but for basic human service, we need to have coverage. And I don't see mandates, and they're few and far between, as being something that's out of reach at all. It's just, and then the other compelling reason, if you don't spend it now, you're going to spend 100 times more later. You know, a colonoscopy, prostate cancer. To have a test, have your insurance company pay for it, and save the insurance company thousands of dollars later on. And to me, it's a good business decision for insurance companies.
I would agree with that.
Thank you very much. And John Powell wants to bring a physician up.
Thank you, Madam.
Thank you. Oh.
Mike.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Mike Becker with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, here to testify in support of Senate Bill 734. And what I would like to do is introduce one of our medical directors, Dr. Ralph Prowse, who will give our testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I just wanted to add a couple of comments.
Say your name for the record.
I'm sorry. Ralph Prowse. And I'm the Senior Medical Director for Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. And I just wanted to lend a word of support to the notion of doing everything we can for tobacco cessation. I think it's hard to go wrong supporting those efforts. It's a huge problem, as you've heard, and I certainly respect the opinion of Dr. Benz in this regard. He really is an expert on that, on this. So I'd like to just lend my word of support behind the effort to stop tobacco use in the state as best we can. I would add one other comment to that, and it would be that tobacco cessation using patches, nicotine replacement therapy, drugs like Chantix and others are good, they're fine, but they really need to be coupled with efforts toward behavior modification, support programs. And so when I speak with employers and we talk about tobacco cessation programs, we really talk about the need to combine the use of medications with coaching techniques, with programs like Free and Clear, and we try to offer those as package options to employers because they are more effective done that way in a combined and supportive approach. So I would advocate for that as well. I would ask that you consider ways of promoting both techniques, both the drugs as well as the behavior modification approaches to tobacco cessation. I am delighted to see the progress that's been made nationally and also in Oregon over the last a couple of decades, and recently with the Public Employee Benefit Board and those employees, where we've had a strong tobacco cessation program in place for a few years now, combining medication with the Free and Clear program. We're seeing cessation rates as high as 43% in that population, and that's really what we want to see. Those are extremely good results. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right. With no further discussion, we're waiting for the fiscal. It looks like if it's the will of the committee, we'll move this as soon as we get the fiscal. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 734. And I'll open, let's open a work session on 529. That should be an easy one to get out of the way. Mr. Shook?
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 529 directs the Department of Human Services to establish a position to act as liaison between department and communities that may become sites of transitional housing facilities. You heard this bill about a month ago. There was a -1 amendment, which you have in your packet. There is a fiscal and a revenue of -1.
And I looked it over.
Session?
Yeah, we're in work session.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 529.
Senator Cruz moves the -1s to Senate Bill 529. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 529 as amended with the -1 amendment to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 529 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. And Senator Cruz, would you carry that bill? And we'll close the public hearing on 529. And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 796. Mr. Schiff?
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 796 requires death care consultants to be licensed by the State Mortuary and Cemetery Board. It also has a number of other provisions that's in your packet. Senator Walker was here to testify. I don't see her, so we may want to consult without her.
Okay. Why don't we start without her? She said she could be here at 8:45, and knowing her, she will be here at 8:45. So let's call Ty Cochran and is it Mark Stinn? And Michelle Gaines can come up too. She's here. Have all three of you up here. And whoever wants to go first can start by introducing yourself first.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Stinn. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Funeral Directors Association. And we're here today to support Senate Bill 796 as amended. We've worked closely with Mortuary Cemetery Board as well as Senator Walker's office on this bill. I've submitted some comments in writing, and I'll keep my comments short. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Give us a little bit of history on well, let's wait for the panel, and then we'll ask questions. Okay.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ty Cochran. I'm the legislative liaison for the Cemetery Association of Oregon. I've been in the industry for over 25 years and 15 years down here as the legislative liaison for the Cemetery Association. I've never seen a better working relationship with the two agencies that regulate our business, one being the DCBS and the other the Oregon State Cemetery and Mortuary Board. Michelle Gaines, of course, being the new executive director, has worked extremely hard with the Oregon Funeral Directors Association and the Cemetery Association and other people from our industry and brought together all the players to see that bills like this one do nothing but further to protect the consumers of Oregon. Senate Bill 796 is a very clean bill. The portion concerning private burial grounds has been addressed, and it allows the State Board to adopt rules promoting environmentally sound death care practices. I would ask that this agency work with the industry in adopting the administrative rules and other rulemakings that come out of this bill or any other of the 40-plus bills that are affecting our industry down here. I want to say I could give you some of the drivers behind this concept, but Michelle's here, of course, and Senator Walker's going to be here, and I think that you're going to get a little better information from them with the crux of all the material in the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Michelle Gaines, and I'm the Executive Director of the Mortuary and Cemetery Board. We license facilities and practitioners in the death care industry, a segment of health that is often overlooked because we avoid death and its consequences because it often makes many of us uncomfortable. Many people are only exposed to this industry through the lens of popular culture, Most people do not plan for death, and even those who do are still often not prepared for the impacts of grief or for the impacts an individual's death may bring to all facets of the lives of those that are left behind. What we have then is the need for an industry and for practitioners in that industry who can provide a variety of services to meet the needs of an increasingly more and more diverse population, which in turn has a variety of cultural, religious, geographic, and financial needs. And by the very dynamics of death, the overwhelming majority of customers will also be emotionally strained or ill-informed as to the options and practices available to them. Proper care of the dead, even though we don't like to think about death, is also essential for the protection of public health and safety. We must accept as a community that death is inevitable for us all. We must address it. We must not allow our discomfort to turn away the community lens. We must be constantly vigilant on behalf of those who serve in this industry, as well as those most vulnerable populations who find themselves engaging those services. For these reasons, proper standards of practice, a diverse industry offering in support of consumer needs, and appropriate regulatory oversight are essential. Senate Bill 796, in my opinion, is a landmark opportunity for Oregon to address with eyes wide open the need and impacts of death on Oregonians, on communities, on the workforce and economy, and on the environment. Specifically, this bill opens up the law to encourage the development and use of new so-called disposition technologies, which ultimately provide for greater consumer choice as well as address increasing concerns around the environmental impact of current disposition methods, issues such as mercury emission or carbon footprint. This bill recognizes that all Oregonians have the fundamental right to make their own funeral arrangements, and that the person with the legal right to control disposition of another has the right to perform those duties on their own behalf, but at the same time it recognizes that many people may not know what to do in order to do it themselves. They may need assistance, and they may seek choices in the type of service provider that they would choose. While this bill recognizing an emerging segment of interest in funeral service practitioners that can provide alternatives, death midwives or death care consultancy, folks that work with families to be closely involved in the final arrangements of their loved ones, the bill supports the choice, but it also enforces standards of practice for funeral service practitioners so that there are sufficient consumer protection controls in place to prevent harm and abuse. This bill sets the stage for in-depth discussion on the greening of death care. It directs the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board to work with stakeholders to develop clear standards and definitions that would help us clearly understand the environmental impacts of our final choices in life, while at the same time provide an important clear measure to protect the consumer from any misuse of the term green in marketing or sales practices. This bill clarifies ambiguity around the definition of an indigent, as well as the process of care and the disposition of indigent remains in the state. This bill supports a family's existing right for private burial on lands they own, but it adds clarification of the requirements for ownership as well as standards for record keeping and disclosure. It leaves the decision for specific laws and requirements at the local level where it is best maintained, but requires local jurisdictions to report their requirements to the state so that we can establish a clearinghouse of information to address increasing consumer demand for this information across the various local jurisdictions. Finally, the bill also adds language to our existing laws that recognizes that as we become an increasingly global and mobile society, we simply no longer find entire families located in the same geographic area. And yet, our need to grieve, to remember, to visit a fixed point, be it a 5-foot granite marker or a GPS coordinate in a woodland field, this need will continue to drive the use of cenotaphs or memorial markers where there may not be remains interred to commemorate a life, but which may not actually mark where the remains themselves are kept. It may be actually quite geographically distant. This could ultimately create a new type of cemetery or business, one without any remains in it at all. And given the purpose of these memorials, any such business should be held to the same standard of expectation of access and ongoing existence as any other memorial park. The Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery formally supports this bill and urges your decision in support of this critical conversation. Thank you.
All right. There are questions. Yes, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you explain what a death care consultant is? And I noticed we have a funeral service practitioner we reference, an embalmer, but we've created a new designation as a death care consultant. And I noticed in Section 4, it requires a license and pass an examination, but I don't see a definition in the statute.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, I'll start off and then there may be other comments here. It is difficult. Under statute right now, anybody that for payment offers any kind of funeral service or goods is functioning as a funeral service practitioner. What we have is an emerging segment of practitioners that they don't all necessarily use the same title, which makes it difficult to classify. Their services also vary along a spectrum from individuals that may simply provide educational material to folks who will actually go into the home and do hands-on setting of features or preparation of remains that falls under what would fall under an embalmer license. What this is intending to do is to get clarification within Oregon to set some standards of practice for folks that are going to use these emerging titles and be clear that there needs to be a standard of practice around funeral service, and then depending on where those individuals are on that spectrum, that they have the appropriate licenses to be able to perform and offer those services for payment.
Madam Chair, I thank you very much. It occurs to me in going through the bill here that maybe there needs to be a process to create this by rule, what the qualifications are, and I don't see that in the bill.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, I believe in the -1 amendment there was some language that was a little more specific about allowing the board to set by rule criteria and to an extent any kind of titling licensure on that.
We just got the amendments.
These are the
-1s.
These are the
-1s. Senator Walker, all three have testified, and if you wanted to give your testimony, and then Senator Morse had some questions about the definition of a death care consultant.
Okay, great. So you all have given the whole report? Oh, man.
Not really.
I find
best for last.
Bill, fascinating. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. Thank you. I had a conference call this morning on another committee that I chair. I love this bill because it is, well, it's an interesting subject. Nobody really wants to talk about death, first of all.
Let Senator Walker take on an interesting subject.
Yeah, Madam Chair, you and I talked about tissue banks last session. No one wants to talk about that either because it can be kind of gruesome. But, you know, there's two things in life that are certain. One, you're born, and one, you die. I mean, you just can't get around that. Well, you could get around not being born, I suppose, but, we are all going to die, and we need to deal with these issues. And what is fascinating is that the baby boomers, like me, like you, we all kind of like things a little different. We don't like things to be like our grandfather's or our father's Oldsmobile. We want it a little bit different. So some of us might want to be freeze-dried. I find that fascinating. Some of us want to be cremated. You can go in the resonator, and that's part of the liquefying process. It was all really interesting. You can be frozen, which my daughter wanted to be until Ms. Gaines here told her about what happens when they freeze you. So she's rethinking that right now, how she wants her end-of-life care to be taken care of. And then you have this new death midwife, they call it. And they've also called it a doula. Now, my friend's daughter is a doula, but that's a birth doula. You help in a midwife fashion. And so they're taking this phraseology and they're turning it around so it's both applicable to birth and death. So they call them death midwives. Well, my issue is that we have not very much in our state law about all these newfangled ways of dying and being disposed of. And so that's why I was very excited about wanting to do something about this, and was excited that the new director of the Cemetery Mortuary Board was so intrigued by it all, and wanting to clean up our statutes and making sure that we have the things necessary in place. In addition, as you probably heard, we do indigent burial, quote, burial. I mean, it's disposition. And we don't have enough money to fund the program. We have far more indigent people. I will tell you, I'll just give you firsthand experience. My mother-in-law has been living at home under OPI, Oregon Project Independence, 40 hours a month of care, and she could no longer stay in her home. She's on oxygen. She fell. She went to the hospital last week. And we now have to put her in a nursing home because she's not capable of assisted living either. So we had to address that situation with her about end-of-life care, and that's not the time that you do that. It really should be the time when you're not in the hospital, when you're comfortable, you're talking around the dinner table, you're just having conversation. It shouldn't be when you're in the hospital and you're thinking your life is nearly over. That's a very bad time, and I wouldn't recommend it on anyone. But then there are so many options to look at, and you really need to understand what those options are. We had to spend down her money, and so we bought her a prepaid cremation plan. We asked her, and she said she didn't care. I'm of the opinion I prefer cremation, so the family chose cremation, and Grandma's okay with that. But the point is that, you know, when families have a loved one who passed on, that is a very vulnerable time. I remember when my father-in-law passed away, it was the first death that I really had to deal with. And it's the first time in my life I was not in control. And you all know me, and I'm very much in control of my life. And I felt out of control. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know the first step to take. But amazingly, you call the mortuary and you go in and they know what to do. My point is, they know what to do. They're licensed by the state. But death midwives and all these newfangled things, there is no consumer protection, and that's what this bill is about, is trying to establish in law some consumer protection. We also want to know if you're burying Grandma on the property. I mean, that's pretty important. I had Ms. Gaines talk to the Realtors Association, and Jana tried to catch me this morning, and they had a teeny issue with the bill, but they think if you could take out some little element of it, it would be just fine. But you need to know if Grandma's buried on the property. There were a number of articles out here. Texas was in the process of a huge development, and they unearthed like 13 bodies, and it was an unidentified burial site. And, you know, in the Wild West, there were a lot of unidentified burial sites. Also, the low-income African-Americans were often, it's horrible what happened to these folks, but they would bury them and give them no marker, nothing. So we're in the modern age today. There should be no excuse for burying someone with no marker, and we need to know if you're going to bury them on your property and if you're going to be purchasing that property, whether there's a burial ground in the back. There's a new thing called cenotaphs as well. Didn't have a clue what that was till I read the bill and got the definition, and they may have talked about it already. It's basically a memorial, and there's no person there. The person's body may be somewhere else. It may be overseas. It may just be somewhere else, and you create a memorial park. Well, we need to have that definition in statute as well. And so this bill attempts to do all those things. It attempts to do quite a bit, but I think it is time to do quite a bit, and I have to tell you, I am so impressed with Michelle Gaines sitting next to me. I'm going to embarrass her because I told her the other day when she sent me an email, it was so detailed about what we're trying to do, what are the positives, what are the negatives, and I mean, I said, I've never met anyone so organized as myself outside of my own daughter. And so, Michelle, you are top notch, especially compared with the problems that we had with this board's previous executive director. And I think Senator Moore knows well about that because we served on the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means, and we had this budget in our subcommittee before. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's what I'm here about, is just setting up those parameters, making sure we've got consumer protection. If people want to do this burial in these biodegradable little boxes made out of cornstarch, you know, and do that whole earthy thing, that's fine. I just want parameters around it and making sure there's consumer protection, because certainly, as I indicated, it's a very vulnerable time when you're dealing with death, even though we all know it's coming.
All righty. Would Janet Jarvis come up and just let...
Chair.
Oh, you have...
I had one question,
okay.
Yeah. Just want to make a little clarification, I guess, for me. First, thanks for the testimony, and Senator Walker, great to see you this morning. I had a great morning until this started up, but it's been going good, okay? And being a former resident of Detroit, Michigan, there's some unmarked graves there, too.
We're still
looking for Jimmy. So, you know.
Okay.
On the Dash 1 amendments, on page 5, it speaks to, I believe it speaks to allowing bodies to be given or moved to teaching facilities for anatomy. And that's in the bill. And the only question I had about it, which seemed a little strange to me, is that the phrase, if no one claims the body within 5 days after the funeral petitioner takes custody of the body, 5 days seems a little tight time-wise, considering that we have people visiting and people from out of the area, and it might be somewhat difficult to not, once you got the person identified, to try to find anybody. Is that, I'm just asking, is that a reasonable time, five days? I mean, you know, you can think of a weekend being involved here, or holiday weekends, and maybe you find a family member later who says, no, that's not what we wanted. Is 5 days an adequate and reasonable time? It just seems a little short to me, is all.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I think typically when the funeral home, by the time the funeral home takes possession of a deceased person, there's already been some of that legwork done, and so an additional 5 days to allow us to try to find relatives or family members should be sufficient.
Okay. I'm going to rely on their experience doing this, not mine, so. I have no luck with that, so.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I have no experience with that either, and so I defer to the experts on that. And I do want to apologize. The Dash 1 amendments I got last week, but Ms. Gaines and I were reviewing them with the possibility of maybe making some further amendments. So I woke up in the middle of the night wondering, oh my gosh, did I get those Dash 1 amendments to the committee and send a text to my staff and got the answer this morning? I don't think so. So we got those down to you as quickly as we could. And so that was really my snafu, because I saw them all in my bill file last night when I was reviewing this matter after I retired into bed. I read at night. I went to bed with this on my mind last night, so I had interesting nightmares. I mean, it was interesting.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Members of the committee, one last comment is that Senator Morse had brought up the administrative rule processing and formulating what the definition of a death care consultant would be, and I want to be on the record making sure that this agency asks representatives from the Funeral Directors Association of the Cemetery to help them with those administrative rules, because we do have the experience and expertise in a lot of those areas.
Do you want to say something for the board that you'll do that?
Madam Chair, for the record, yes, on behalf of the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board, we will absolutely work with the associations and appreciate their expertise on the matter.
Thank you. All right.
Just a question, Madam Chair. Obviously, this is something that does need to be dealt with. Things have changed in the last 30 years, and I thank Senator Walker for bringing this forward. And I also know I've heard peripherally that the Mortuary Board is changing dramatically and really moving forward and being properly funded and all those things. Question is, we're running a little short on time. We've got a couple of weeks to move bills, and I thought I heard there might be a Dash 2 potentially for changing something. Maybe we should look forward to seeing that quickly and get this bill going.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, the Dash 2 would be the amendment that the realtors want, and it's simply, as I was talking to Ms. Jarvis coming in, she just showed me some words she wants to cross out. So that can be done and have back to you this week, and unless these folks here had an additional amendment. that I didn't hear about before
no.
I came in.
I'm.
What do we have, Ms. Jarvis?
Yeah, I would like to have Ms. Jarvis come up, and then if the mortuary board would stay to respond, so that it's you two that will work on that amendment with Senator Walker. Have you seen the dash twos?
Good morning.
The dash ones?
No, I have not.
Okay, thank
you. So, thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, for the record, Jana Jarvis representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I do want to take a quick second and thank both Senator Walker and Michelle for notifying me about Senate Bill 796. When we read the bill description, this is one of the few issues realtors typically don't follow, so we did miss the section in the bill that related to the seller's property disclosure, and so I'm grateful to them for pointing that out to me.
And the section is?
And the section is Section 16, I believe. Yes. In the original version of the bill. Our concern is that the seller's property disclosure is a document that's used which has broad-reaching impacts. And we put questions in there that relate to issues that arise in a large number of transactions. And while certainly I would want to know if there was a dead person buried on my property, I'm not certain that this is a situation that has as broad a reaching impacts as other questions in the seller's property disclosure. Every session there are a number of issues that come before this body, and we try to keep this document and the integrity of this document. We watch it very carefully because we want it to still be valuable in the real estate transaction. I do think there's a way to fix this so that a buyer is notified that there's a property, and that's in Section 9. And so I'd like to offer to work with the proponents of this legislation to see if we can't find a fix so that buyers are aware that there are remains on a property, and yet we do not add that question in Section 16. And that's really my point for today.
Okay, so Senator Walker, will you make sure that the amendment is drafted? As soon as it comes back with your consent, we'll move forward and pass the bill out.
Okay, Madam Chair, I'm happy to do that. And I did indicate to Ms. Gaines that we needed to contact the realtors because they always get the heebie-jeebies about adding things on to the seller's disclosure report and heebie-jeebies. Mm-hmm. I remember one time in Judiciary we had a bill that wanted to add the fact that there were ghosts on the property.
Right.
Do you remember that?
I was going to mention that this morning.
Yeah, and so now we're talking about real ghosts, or at least real dead people. So I am happy to work with her. I think we can hammer it out this morning and get it down and get it back to you. When do you meet again?
Tuesday.
Next Tuesday? Okay, we'll do it next Tuesday then if that's the way.
I mean, we meet Thursday, but it's too late.
You're 48 hours?
Yeah.
Well, actually, you can continue this over.
That's true. All right. Well,
you want to do that.
Very good idea. Yes, Senator Morris.
Just a suggestion to follow up on my previous comment about the definition of a death care consultant. It's clear by the dash ones that the board does have the authority by rule, but I think it would make the bill stronger since you have created a new definition of actually making an attempt to describe what that new position is that you're licensing.
Okay, Madam Chair, Senator Morris will make that attempt, and that may raise some eyebrows from those who don't like the way we've described it, but I think we can do that. And I think we can address Ms. Jarvis's issue, and I think we can get this back to you Thursday, so you can continue this.
Well,
Thursday if you want, or Tuesday.
Thursday, but then we'll have the fiscal. We still don't have the fiscal. So if we can get the amendment Tuesday, then we can let fiscal know.
Okay. Well, we'll get it all done today and get it down to LC, and we'll get it to you much more quickly than this time around.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
All right, with that, if you want to stay put, Senator Walker, I'm going to close. First of all, let's just have this scheduled for the following Tuesday because we still need to get the fiscal. And so I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 796, and I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 864. And
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 864 prohibits insurance policy or contract with prescription drug coverage from excluding coverage for drugs that are prescribed or covered condition and for which no generic equivalent is available. if in clinical judgment of prescribing physician there is no appropriate therapeutic alternative.
And Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm pleased to be here today on Senate Bill 864. You should have a dash 2 amendment in front of you. I'm going to let the party speak to that. I introduced this legislation at the request of the Oregon Rheumatology Alliance and through their local physician, Dr. Cody Wassner. He is my constituent, came to me in the interim to discuss this problem that they were having with Regents Insurance Corporation, not allowing them to prescribe a drug for fibromyalgia that is the only FDA-approved treatment for fibromyalgia. So it forces them to have their patients use non-approved, less expensive medications, and they are non-approved drugs by the FDA. There's only one drug approved for the use of fibromyalgia, for the treatment of fibromyalgia. And the Rheumatology Alliance believes this is a clear violation of good pharmacy and medical practice, and I would have to agree. So that is why I brought this before you today. You know, early on, Madam Chair, in the whole structure of medicine, when HMOs took over, it became practice for HMOs and board of directors to decide the medical treatment of patients, and they took that away from the doctors, much like Measure 11 took away sentencing guidelines from judges. We have boards and directors and insurance executives making decisions about medical care and usurping a doctor's authority. I believe that is not the way medicine should be practiced. I understand what this is supposed to do in theory, but in theory what happens is the patient ends up going through all these other treatments that don't work, spending a lot of time and money, because I have to tell you, time going to the doctor is valuable time in my view. My worldview, especially living here in the legislature now, my only doctor is one who has graciously decided to help all of us in need, and that's our resident colleague and physician, Alan Bates. And you are our resident nurse, Madam Chair, and I meant to get up to your office to take my blood pressure yesterday, but I'll do it today. But my point of it is that, you know, it is time and money for us to do what we need to do as patients too. And so when we go to a doctor who knows how to treat these issues and they're denied the right to prescribe the only FDA-approved drug for that condition, well then what are we supposed to do as consumers? So, Madam Chair, with that, I'd like to introduce you to the folks who can speak better to this bill than I and why they've drafted the Dash 2 to address this problem. So unless you have any questions for me, I'll make my exit.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Walker. And we'll call up Dr. Elizabeth Tyndall and Dr. Cody,
Wassner.
Wassner.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you,
Committee.
Whoever wants to go first, introduce yourself.
I'm Dr. Cody Wassner. I'm a rheumatologist in Eugene, Oregon for the last 29 years. And Madam Chair and the chair people, I appreciate being able to talk here today. We're not sophisticated at these kinds of proceedings, so please bear with us here. About 9 years ago, we started a nonprofit advocacy group called the Oregon Rheumatology Alliance. There are about 35 rheumatology specialists in Oregon. This is arthritis specialists. And at that time, we found that there were some difficulties in us being able to practice with our patients. We have chronic patients who we see over and over for years and years. We initially started by providing books to all the libraries in Oregon about arthritis, and then eventually we became more of an advocacy group with mostly with the insurance companies and trying to make sure that we could preserve our relationship with the patients and the medicines and things. And this specific bill is not just about Regents or any specific insurance company. It's about the insurance companies in general, and it's just that Regents is a prominent insurance company here. The issue that we've had to face is a new one, and this new one is what we call forced off labeling. And it came up because of a disease called fibromyalgia, which is a very painful chronic condition. It's not very flashy, and so it has not had a lot of medications available for it, and it has not had a lot of study. Recently, new medicine became available, and the first approved medicine for fibromyalgia. It went through all the FDA testing, etc. We had had other medicines before this that were not officially approved, but this was the first medicine that was officially approved for fibromyalgia. There are now three approved medicines. What we found when we tried to use this medicine was that the insurance companies were requiring what we call forced off labeling. They were saying that we needed to first fail three other medications which were not approved. Now, they have been used in the past, but they really weren't approved for this medicine, so for this condition. So now we had three medicines that were available that we couldn't use until the patient failed three non-approved medicines. You know, my goal for the last 30 years is to take as good of care of patients as possible. This is what I spend time doing all day, every day. We spend all our time studying these medicines and how they get developed and whether they work or not. And so it was very frustrating to realize that now if I suggested to a patient that they take this approved medicine, that they couldn't do it, and not only couldn't they do it, but I would have to give them medicines which I've already said I thought weren't the best choice for them. And having to fail three of those means that either they had to take three and not get effects, or they had to get side effects before they could take the approved medicine. And this is a new situation that's distressful for us, because really medical care is delivered not between the insurance company and the patient, but between the doctor and the patient. And in this kind of situation, we really were handicapped, and it placed the patient and myself and the other rheumatologists in the state in a very unusual position. So we initially applied to the Board of Pharmacy and filed a complaint saying that this is, you know, not really appropriate for our care of patients, and they said it wasn't in their jurisdiction, and they referred us to the Board of Medicine, and the Board of Medicine said it wasn't in their jurisdiction, referred us to the, and this took several months each time, and then the third one was to the insurance division, and they said that that was not in their division, that they only handled individual complaints from individual patients. So we had individual patients send in complaints, and they said that it wasn't in their province. So we come here asking for you folks to consider the possibility of not allowing this forced off labeling. Now, this is not an unusual request. Medicare has just in their 2010 guidelines really decried this practice and said that it's not appropriate, and it's clearly not something that Medicare will allow in the next year. It's also unusual in that other states do not allow this. There are only a few states that have this kind of forced off labeling allowed. So we think that this bill might allow us to appropriately deal with the patient and their medications, and not put our patients at a disadvantage. It's a little hard to understand with fibromyalgia, because it's not a very common condition, but to extend this to another illness, imagine if you came down with breast cancer, and I came into the office and I said, I want to use this treatment for you because it's approved for breast cancer and we think it's a new effective treatment, but I can't. You have to fail three other medications before you can take this one. Now, for breast cancer, that would be ridiculous. And we also think it's probably true for fibromyalgia as well and other conditions. It's not that we don't recognize that the insurance companies have some input in the process, but this specific forced off labeling is a new escalation that we think is not good for our patients and good for our doctor-patient relationship. And Dr. Tindall will explain the details of the bill, but I'm glad to answer any questions I can.
Thank you. Let's have you, and then we'll have questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Elizabeth Tindall, and I began my private practice of rheumatology in Portland, Oregon in 1982, and currently I'm on the clinical faculty at Oregon Health and Science University. I have no financial interest whatsoever in this condition and no relationship at all with any of the three pharmaceutical makers. And I think that's important because frequently I think physicians are discredited by other people saying, oh gosh, you just are a shill. You're just working for the company. And that is not the case whatsoever. This has been a long-standing situation that we've had with Regents. And the situation is that we've had an ongoing working relationship with them for many years. Dr. Wozner and I and other members of the Oregon Rheumatology Alliance have had the ability to go in and review policy and to work with them on what is appropriate for treating our patients. This issue has pretty much severed our relationship with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield, and we feel that's unfortunate. We do not have a seat at the table, and as they say, if you don't have a seat at the table, then frequently you're on the menu. And we sort of feel like we're a bit on the menu here, as are our patients. I was past president of the American College of Rheumatology in 2005, and that was the year when Vioxx and Bextra were taken off the market. So I testified before the FDA, and I'm certainly familiar with the difficulty it is to get a pharmaceutical drug approved. If you look at some of the studies that are done with these now three drugs that have been approved, these are thousands of patients who have been tested very carefully over years for this indication. And that's opposed to sort of an ad hoc, well, we'll just try whatever we've got. It may not work, but, you know, here it is. I think the downside is that the liability really falls upon the physician. You prescribe a drug that's not approved and an adverse event occurs, you are responsible for that patient. If that patient has to be hospitalized or has other untoward events, as in the case of amitriptyline, which is one of the drugs that they recommend be used, Elavil, it's an old tricyclic antidepressant. It's been around forever. It is very inexpensive, but it's also not very effective. And patients who have cardiac arrhythmias, who have serious weight gain, who may have fatigue, fuzzy thinking, the like, do not tolerate this drug well at all. The NIH actually did a review of 27 studies with tricyclic and other antidepressants. And this review looked at how efficacious, how effective are these drugs. And they said over the 6 to 12-week period of time they were studied, only about 25-26% of those patients showed any improvement at all. That's not very good. Admittedly, there's not been a head-to-head comparison, but that's because the FDA has not been mandated or required to do head-to-head comparisons. The same way with Neurontin, which is one of the other drugs that they are recommending. Neurontin is an anti-seizure drug. It is not approved for fibromyalgia, and patients who take Neurontin also may not receive significant benefit. These are, again, things that we used to do, and we don't want to go back to the days in rheumatology where we had gold shots and cortisone, and that was pretty much it for rheumatoid arthritis. And with progress, there is expense with these medications, but as I've heard you all discuss earlier, if you pay now and you do appropriate therapy, perhaps you can keep these people from filing disability or missing time from work. And that is exactly as Senator Walker said. If you have to fail two or three other drugs, you've got to come in to see the physician. You have adverse side effects. You're missing time from work. You have the cost of paying for prescriptions that aren't approved. And then we as a physician are pretty much acting as go-betweens. We're responsible, and yet we're not allowed to treat as we see appropriate. So we find this really a significant intrusion on the patient-physician relationship. The American College of Rheumatology also wrote a letter to Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield protesting this. The ACR, the American College of Rheumatology, feels that therapeutic substitution, which is essentially what this is, there are no generics for these three drugs because they're too new. We feel that that's not appropriate if there are, in fact, FDA-approved therapies. I think that the insurance company still has some alternatives. If, in fact, they feel that it's not appropriate for a particular patient to receive a specific drug, they can demand a prior authorization. They can demand to review the medical records to see if, in fact, does this patient have fibromyalgia? Do they fit the criteria? What are the considerations that the physician has given to this issue? And that's done all the time, and that puts a speed bump in the road. It doesn't mean that every patient will get everything, but at least it will allow us to prescribe what is accepted now in the medical community as the standard of care. The last thing I'll say about fibromyalgia, and it's actually about 2 to 4% of patients, predominantly women, and you can see it by itself, a chronic pain syndrome, poor sleep, frequently depression. Maybe 25% of patients with fibromyalgia go on disability. That's significant. So if you can keep those individuals working and functioning and not losing time because they're so fuzzy in their thinking or they're so in so much pain, I think that society on the whole is much better off. Last year, I'll say one last thing. Last year, I was asked to give an overview of rheumatoid arthritis to the Social Security judges of the United States. They came here to Portland. Every year, they pick a city, and they pick Portland. And they asked me to do an overview of rheumatoid arthritis and disability. So I did 3 or 4 hours. I did cases. I did this is how you diagnose this. This is how you treat it. All of the questions were on fibromyalgia. They said, you know, we get rheumatoid. We understand that. What is this fibromyalgia? Why are we seeing so many patients coming in wanting disability for this? You know, is it real? How do you treat it? How do you diagnose? So they showed to me that that's the real issue. That's really where we're coming to, I think, a crossroads, is trying to keep our patients working and productive at home and in society. So if there are any questions for Dr. Wasner, I would be happy to take them.
At this point, I think we'll get the opponents of the bill up, and then we may have questions for you, all right?
Stay up here while they speak.
With that, Dr. Mike Stewart and Dr. Ralph Prowse, and Helen Sherman. Whoever wants to go first, introduce yourself. And
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Stewart. I am from Seattle. I'm a physician. A little bit of background. Well, first of all, I should say I'm in opposition to 864 because we are trying to do the best we can in taking care of patients by using drugs that work. And I'm going to elaborate on that. But my background is I was a practicing physician at Group Health in Seattle for 30 years. About half that time, I chaired a committee, the P&T Committee, Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee, or the Technology Assessment Committee, and headed a department that was devoted to quality improvement in healthcare. And so I got a lot of experience looking at things that didn't work. For the last 7 years, I've had my own company, Delphini, which is really doing business as Mike Stewart, which is a company that helps healthcare organizations and health plans determine whether things work. And so I've worked with Kaiser Permanente. In fact, I am currently. I have been an advisor to Regents and other health plans, many medical groups, including Group Health and many others across the country, including the government, Medicare, the Defense Department, and others. But what I do is called practical evidence-based medicine. And to make a long story short here, there are going to be very big unintended consequences if this bill passes, in my opinion. And I'm speaking also just as a citizen. What we want is to protect patients from harms. And what we want is to find drugs and interventions, technologies that work. And the only way that can be done is through science, looking at whether something works in a scientific way. If something doesn't work, using it is inappropriate. And as currently, we don't need any more inappropriate care. The Institute of Medicine, RAND Corporation, Dartmouth Group, they all estimate the amount of inappropriate care in the United States to be between 20 and 50%. If you have a situation where we go backwards, which this bill will do, by allowing physicians who don't do critical appraisal of the studies to make decisions that overrule committees that have non-involved physicians and others who know how to look at studies and drugs to see if they work, then we're moving away from what the current administration's doing with their comparative effectiveness. We're moving away from what is now an accepted way of looking at efficacy and safety through evidence-based medicine. So in my opinion, what's going to happen here is that we will go back to what the people at Dartmouth found 30 years ago, is there will be infinite variation. Physicians will decide, I'm going to use this drug without any critical appraisal. And we've done numerous tests and found that practicing physicians, by and large, have not been taught, as I was not originally, how to critically read studies or to do science or to know whether many new drugs work. So these committees actually function in a way that is very, very responsible. They're not just cost-saving. They're looking at whether drugs work, and patients need to be protected through the same scientific approach that allows us to know that something's safe before many, many people take it and are actually potentially harmed by it. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but I strongly oppose this for the reasons I've stated.
So you think that the physicians that just testified weren't being using what did you call it? Critical appraisal of studies, hadn't done their due diligence.
Well, let me put it this way. I would say that in general, the physicians that are practicing medicine in this country look at the abstract, the short summary in a study. They look at what their colleagues tell them, and they get a consensus, but they do not do this critical appraisal. That is correct. They have not, most of the time, they have not learned how. You heard about Vioxx. Vioxx was withdrawn in 2004. Our committee looked at this in 2000 when the studies came out and said, this drug doesn't work, and it causes more harm than good. So we said, thumbs down on Vioxx, but many, many groups and many physicians, and I remember walking around the hospital hearing physicians saying, there's this great new drug, Vioxx. It's FDA approved. It's a great drug, and it causes 50% fewer gastric ulcers than the older anti-inflammatory drugs. These are COX-2s. Well, it turns out that the 50% was 50% of 0.8 of 1%. So in other words, it went from a tiny small number to another tiny small number, and all the physicians got had by that. And that's just one example. We had many antiarrhythmic drugs, Inconide, Flecainide. I used them. We all used them. They caused 5 out of 100 people to die until we had good science. We didn't even look at the science. So, yes, I'd say the biggest problem is that physicians read fatally flawed studies about 5 to 30% of studies can be trusted, and so you have to do this critical appraisal, even though New England Journal, Annals of Internal Medicine, JAMA, Lancet, all the big journals, they agree with the principles, but they publish studies that are fatally flawed. So we have to have critical appraisal to actually know whether a drug works.
Still, when you're a part of, when you're in a specialty,
right,
like rheumatology,
mm-hmm,
and the Oregon Rheumatology Alliance, these are people who are used to working with these specific patients and with the variety of drugs.
Yes.
And you still want to trump what they feel is appropriate medical care for their particular patient.
It's almost like, first of all, the intent is, there's no problem with the intent, but the process should go like this. The FDA approval is a very, very low hurdle. Or we wouldn't have drugs that are withdrawn all the time, or that hurt people, or that don't work. So even if it's FDA approved, you now need people to do critical appraisal of the studies, and they're not going to agree with the FDA many times. So the step after that is, physicians should participate in this process, but they should not be immune from the process of this critical appraisal of the science, because otherwise we'll have what we've had for many, many years, which is folks like me, before I learned how to do this, making inappropriate healthcare decisions because the science was flawed.
Okay. Let's hear from the rest of the panel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and appreciate the opportunity to come and to speak to the committee today. Thank you, Senators. My name is Ralph Prowse. I'm the Senior Medical Director for Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield, and I guess I've gotten the title of senior because I've been practicing for 32 years and still do practice. And in the course of my career, I have worked in several large medical groups. I've taught at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center in Worcester. I have created and I have chaired several pharmacy and therapeutics committees in my career. And I'm here today to oppose this bill. And I think it's important to understand what this bill is really all about. And with all due respect to the rheumatologists that you've heard today, I believe physicians in general are trying to do the very best thing that they can for their patients. And I remember way back in my earliest years of practice, perhaps Senator Bates will remember the Guerin gastric bubble like I do. For patients who were overweight, we thought this was the greatest thing since sliced bread, and we provided that recommendation for many of them, only to find out later that those balloons had a tendency to break, and then they would cause intestinal obstruction, requiring surgery, and there were deaths as a result of that. And so the history here is one of the pharmaceutical industry promoting new devices and new drugs based on FDA approval for whatever use they promote them for, but prematurely. And the FDA is, as my colleague to my right stated, a rather low hurdle. The FDA does not require head-to-head comparisons around safety or effectiveness, and certainly they don't consider the cost implications of the new drugs or devices that are brought to market. Hence, you don't know if Lyrica, you don't know if Cymbalta is truly better than the gold standards that have been tried and true and used for years. You don't know if they're as safe. And certainly in the case of the Guerin gastric balloon, it wasn't. And in the case of Vioxx, Bextra, or Celebrex, which was promoted by Pfizer, the same company that is promoting Lyrica for fibromyalgia, Lotrinex, Iressa, Paladrone, Exubera, Zelnorm, these are all drugs that were promoted prematurely to market, drugs that once we looked at the studies, both published and unpublished studies, and vetted the literature, found they were not as suitable as drugs that had been around for these conditions for quite some time. They had not been proven to be any safer, and they had not been proven to be as effective or more effective. They certainly have high cost implications. What we also know is that the pharmaceutical industry is and has been incredibly influential on the decisions that physicians make. And physicians, you know, they do consult multiple sources for information, their colleagues, their professional associations like the Oregon Rheumatology Alliance, the literature, and they listen to the drug reps who bring donuts into their offices and sponsor them with honoraria and place them on advisory groups. I probably get a solicitation from a pharmaceutical company once a week to have my all expenses paid. Last week it was to Hilton Head. They were going to pay me a $2,000 per diem to attend all of my expenses so that I could sit and advise them how to bring a product to market and how to position that in the market. And I turn those down. Those are conflicts of interest. But there is a strong influence on the prescribing pen of the physician and that prescription pad. And writing under the influence is no better than driving under the influence. And it's the physicians who make the worst pilots because they're the ones that think they can make it over the next mountain and they don't need to do the checklist and the gas gauge. So,
oh boy.
You know, there is a strong influence, and it's been physicians who have written those prescriptions for the Bextras and the Vioxx and all those other medications. And what you aren't going to hear about today is testimony from the victims of those prescribing habits who died or were injured as a result of those prescriptions. What you might find is, if you look, the April 1st, an auspicious date, Journal of the American Medical Association that just published this article titled Professional Medical Associations and the Relationships with Industry, a proposal for controlling conflict of interest. And the medical literature over the last 2 years has been replete with examples of how the pharmaceutical industry has influenced the prescribing habits of physicians, even though they like to think that they don't. I can tell you that they do from my own experience, and I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a physician who would deny that they've had some influences. That's why the major medical groups in this country, the leaders in this country, no longer allow pharmaceutical representatives into their facilities to leave samples and literature and donuts.
Pizza.
Or pizza, thank you. So what I'm appealing about here is the fact that right now we don't have the checks and balances in place to protect our consumers against these kinds of influences. We don't have an FDA that's requiring head-to-head comparisons around safety. Should it be safer than existing time-proven drugs? Should they be as or more effective than existing time-proven drugs? And what about the cost implications of these decisions? Those are not requirements of the FDA. The FDA only says, let's see if it's better than a sugar pill. So our position is we need to have some checks and balances in the system. That's what we're trying to do. When we vet the literature, we look at published, and as we know now how important unpublished literature is, pharmaceutical industries have now been caught suppressing valuable information, not bringing forward that information to the FDA or others prior to approval. It's that sort of vetting that we're trying to do. So when we say, hey, maybe it's better to try X, Y, and Z before you go to another medication, which is new and unproven, I think we're doing that based on the fact we've taken our time and we've looked very carefully at the literature. All of our reviews are publicly available through RegentsRx.com. Any physician or any consumer can go there and look at the extent of the research that we do before we come to these conclusions. And we have a fiduciary responsibility right now for 2.5 million people who we provide insurance for to make sure that the benefits we provide are safe and effective. Thank you, members of the committee. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Let's have one more and then we'll
take questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Helen Sherman. I'm a pharmacist, and I'm the chief pharmacy officer. And just a brief comments of things that have been unsaid so far. As the language is crafted in the bill currently, it does have widespread implications on a very large scale. It will stifle innovation. The market and some of the approaches that we use help press pharmaceutical companies to come out with the next new product that's truly better when we do pin it comparatively to existing options. We haven't talked about cost. Our estimates in terms of the impact of cost if this bill were to go forward are a minimum of $5 to $50 million for Oregonians, and that's a very conservative estimate. That's based on generic use trends, and that's assuming they would flatten. If they were to decrease, doubling those figures would easily occur. And then on the point that was raised with regards to excluding coverage versus prior authorization, the bill talks about not excluding coverage, which coverage is not excluded other than for a handful of medications in most benefit plans. It is prior auth. That's the mechanism that we already use as the speed bumps that were talked about by Dr. Tindall previously approach or promote the use of the best medications first, of the medications with the best evidence. Thank you. We will take questions.
Are there questions for this panel? Because I'd like to now bring the others back up.
But questions here first.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, as in all arguments, there's always some truth in both sides, and that's no different in this argument. When I first read this bill, I have some very big concerns about what would this do outside of the specific group we're dealing with, rheumatology. And this is a very far-reaching bill, and I think we have to be very careful with it. Having said that, I have a couple of questions for the panel in front of us. First off, there was one part of the language of this bill that was very intriguing to me. And that intriguing part said that if the Health Resources Commission, not the FDA, but the Health Resources Commission, approved the drug for that treatment program or that diagnosis, then it was appropriate to do so. The Health Resources Commission has done some pretty good work on the things you guys are talking about, and which I accept. And I trust them more than I do the FDA. FDA trials, as you point out, are against placebo. They're not head-to-head. So I'd like to have a comment from this panel on how you felt about the language in the bill about the Health Resources Commission determining a drug was appropriate for that diagnosis.
I think that there is a huge need in this country to have independent, unbiased, careful reviews done of new medications and medical devices. And I think that that is consistent with what the Obama administration is trying to do right now. There's been this need for a long time. There, frankly, are very few independent, unbiased departments or institutions available to do that sort of work. I'm less familiar with the work that the Oregon Resource Commission has done around this, this sort of thing, but somebody needs to do this work. Right now, we're doing it. Because it isn't being done satisfactorily elsewhere.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, with regards to your question, our work around pharmaceuticals has been very much in concert with that of the Oregon Health Resources Commission in terms of conclusions and the approach to the work.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, follow up here. Do you feel the Health Resources Commission is basically working from a background of outcomes, true outcomes?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, yes.
I think they are, too. There's about 10 or 11 different centers around the country doing that. One of those is this one that happens to be at OHSU.
Mm-hmm.
Follow-up question?
Yes. We've had our pharmacists participate on some of the subcommittees, and the conclusions that have come out of that process are very similar to the conclusions that have come out of Regents.
I would follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm hearing here, would you basically accept them as an authority on these issues?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, yes, we do accept them as an evidence-based authority.
Thank you. So that's one part of this bill I particularly liked and would help resolve some of this issue if that language were incorporated. It's lines 15 through 18 in the printed bill, the original bill. I saw that, it was intrigued by it. And the Dash 2 amendments, I'm sorry to take so much time, Madam Chair.
No,
this is really tricky stuff. And the Dash 2 amendments, which you may not have in front of you, it speaks to the idea of whether or not it's appropriate for an insurance company or any other entity to ask a physician to first give a trial to a patient of a drug off-label before a drug that's on-label can be used. And from a medical legal status, I'd like to hear what your position on that would be.
Madam Chair, I'd like to respond to that. Senator Bates, in medicine today, it's common for us to use medications that have been around for a long time that do not carry with them a specific FDA approval for a particular use. Perhaps the majority of medications that are prescribed today don't carry that specific label. Not that that label isn't important, but the label is often a function of specifically what a pharmaceutical company applies for as a label. And that's often an effort to market a drug and find a specific niche for a drug where other drugs may have been used for that purpose for a long time. It doesn't mean that the drug is necessarily any safer, any more effective, and it's probably not less expensive. So I don't think that by itself is a litmus test.
Well,
yes, please.
You may have misunderstood my question, so I'm going to place the question again to you if I can. If a physician chooses on his own to go off-label, or his or her own to go off-label and write a prescription, and take that medical risk and that legal risk with the patient, I believe that's that physician and patient's choice. I have concerns about an insuring agent saying, you must do this drug before you can do the drug that's FDA approved on a medical malpractice issue. There's a significant difference being told before you can get to the drug that is approved by, say, the Health Resource Commission, so you have something to fall back on in court, or if you have a drug that's FDA approved, so you can fall back in court, but being told by an insurer you have to go through these hoops first on a drug that's off-label, I have a problem with that. If the individual physician wants to make the decision, that's his or her decision and his or her risk. I have a real problem with an insurer saying you will do this before you can do that.
I'd like to respond to that, Madam Chair and Senator Bates. I was fortunate enough to train the administrative law judges in California, and what I learned from them was that there is no way to know how a trial will come out. So if you go with the crowd and the community, the quote community standard, you may have safety, but not if there's evidence that someone brings up at the trial that shows that drug or whatever that intervention is really isn't safe and effective. Then, in that case, the off-label or whatever the intervention is that has better evidence may win in that trial. So it isn't a given that there is any safety anywhere with any approach. It's basically going to come out with a triangulation of all these different issues, which are, what does the evidence say? How good is the lawyer in the case? And many, many other issues. But the evidence really does count more and more every year.
Madam Chairman, Senator Bates, FDA approval for specific use also doesn't guarantee any protection for medical malpractice. I think there was a Supreme Court ruling
about that just two weeks ago. Madam Chair, I'm not saying that. That's not the point. And I think you're avoiding the point I'm trying to make, and that's fine. But the point's pretty clear in my mind. If you're pushing a physician in a certain direction to write a drug that's not FDA approved before he can get to a drug that is FDA approved, and I think there's a legal issue for that particular physician doing that. But I'm not going to take up any more time in the committee this morning. I basically agree, frankly, with your overall position on this thing. I think this will drive healthcare costs right through the roof. This has to be handled very carefully. And I'd like to see more work by people like the Health Resources Commission involved in this. Might help all parties to get to good prescribing practices very, very quickly.
Madam Chair, I would like to respond directly then to the point. I guess I haven't done that as directly as the Senator would have liked. So, there are treatment protocols that exist within any medical textbook and that exist within our policies. And those treatment protocols generally do require step therapy. And step therapies, whether we're talking about hypertension or peripheral neuropathy or whatever the condition, or for that matter, fibromyalgia, whatever it is, often involve step therapy, which first use those drugs which are tried and true, shown to be effective, shown to be safe, and shown to be less costly in some cases than drugs that have, are Johnny-come-latelys that have applied for and received specific FDA approval. So I don't think that per se, we should try to avoid what we know to be good medicine, which involves step therapy in many cases.
Okay. What I'd like to do with this bill, because we still have one more bill we need to do before 10, I would like to have the Health Resources Commission come to this committee to talk specifically on the drugs that the Oregon Rheumatology Alliance has been very concerned about, and so have another meeting that way before we go any further. All right, and then you will be able to come back if you would like the proponents of the bill when we have the Health Resources Commission to talk about that, this rheumatology, fibromyalgia specifically. With that, I'll close the public hearing on 864 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 506. Mr.
The huge can of worms.
Shook.
Madam Chair, there were four bills heard earlier this session. Sponsored by the primarily by the OMA, Oregon Medical Association. There have been work groups formed around all four of those bills, and we have one back today. Senate Bill 506 requires insurance companies to allow electronic or telephone access by a provider to specific information regarding claims for reimbursement, and prohibits the insurance companies from denying claim if the provider obtains the information within 72 hours prior to medical service or treatment. And I believe you have the dash one amendments in your packet.
Brian Parrott from OMA, Mike, to start out with, and Courtney, if you want to come.
Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association. I'll allow Brian to talk more about the specifics of the amendment. I did want to just discuss that we did have a work group. We came together with all the insurance industry folks and did our best to come to as many consensus that we could, and this is kind of the outcome of that. So I'll have Brian discuss a little bit more specifically what we did with 506.
Chair Voters, that is Brian Pair with the Medical Oregon Medical Association. With Senate Bill 506, there really were not a lot of changes we made to this, but there was some concern that we were, that the way the bill was drafted, we were trying to require prior authorizations for medical necessity to be done within a 72-hour period, which is an unreasonable amount of time. We had deleted language from ORS 743837, and so in the amendments we put back the language regarding prior authorizations for medical necessity, which was, must be honored for 30 days. There was some concern from the insurance industry regarding the database that is being used and its implementation. We're We pulled out some of the information that we were originally requesting, but left in the remaining information as far as whether the patient is enrolled, whether the treatment or service is covered, whether the deductible has been met, and whether the amount of the copayment or co-insurance. Other than that, there really have not been a lot of changes. There's a distinct difference between the insurance industry and the Oregon Medical Association in who should bear the cost of these. It's the Oregon Medical Association's position that we have a contract with the insurer that we will provide services to their enrollees, and if we contact them and say, is this your enrollee and are they covered for this service, then we should be paid for that service.
Questions at this point? Let's call the next panel, Mike Becker, Regents, Elise Brown, AHIP, and Dave Fiskum, Providence. And I'm not comfortable moving the bill today. Because I just got the amendments, I want to make sure that we know what we're doing here.
Chair Montes-Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Mike Becker with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, here today to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 506. I'd like to make a general comment, first of all. Been a lot of analysis, a lot of work groups over the past couple of years focused on health care reform, particularly cost, quality, and access for the uninsured. And I think it's unfortunate when all this effort has been expended on those very serious matters that we need to address, that we have bills such as this coming up at this time that have nothing to do with cost, quality, or access. The OMA testimony that we just heard talked about the difference of opinion between physicians who have a contract with insurers in regard to participation in networks. And there's this fundamental difference between who should be responsible for payment for the physician's services in these situations of membership determinations. And what that comment ignores is the fact that the fundamental insurance relationship, though, is between the carrier, the insurer, and the member. And it is that relationship which forms the foundation for the payment obligation under the insurance policy. And what Senate Bill 506 does is attempt to alter that fundamental insurance relationship. And in the situation of the contact with the insurance company, require payment of those services rendered within 72 hours of that inquiry. The thing that ignores, the thing that this new procedure ignores is the fact that under current existing insurance code, there are premium grace periods where the carrier must continue to offer the coverage, and if the premium has not been paid, the grace period kicks in, and if it is paid at some time in that grace period, the coverage remains in effect back to the start of that grace period. If the premium is not paid during that grace period, then the coverage ceases to exist at the end of that grace period. So if we throw into that mix the requirement that upon inquiry that the insurance company must make payment for these services within 72 hours, and we're in this grace period, and the premium is not paid, the carrier will not have an insuring relationship with that member ultimately, but will have an obligation to pay for the services provided by the physician. And again, the physician can directly go to that member and receive coverage for those services, or receive payment for those services, when there is no coverage, that the carrier would be obligated for this payment, even if the coverage were to cease to exist. The other thing I wanted to mention is in regard to the civil penalties and the private right of action. There are sufficient existing penalties and market conduct enforcement under the insurance code to enforce the insurance statutes. And finally, just pointing out the irony of the request from OMA to create a private cause of action with recovery of costs and attorney fees in this situation, that how ironic that is from an organization that is generally concerned about tort reform and limited causes of action against physicians. With that, I'll close my testimony. Thank you.
Madam Chair, for the record, Dave Fiscom, representing Providence Health Health System this morning, as well as a part of our system, Providence Health Plans. First thing to do is associate myself with all of Mr. Becker's remarks. I agree with him. Secondly, Madam Chair, you said you'd only had a moment to review the amendments. I am still waiting for a definitive review of these amendments from Providence Health Plans. I want to thank Mr. Shook for sending these out to us late last week. I have early reactions to them, but we would benefit from a couple more days for review, and I know you're not passing the bill today, so that will give us the time we need to be more specific in our reactions. I guess the general concern that we would have is that we are not sure yet that the language of the amendments you have before you actually reflect work group proceedings. I'm not saying they don't. I'm not saying they do. We're still assessing that. We did have a Providence Health Plans person sitting there for several hours with Mr. Shook and others the day we had a meeting, and I thank him for his efforts in that regard. I guess generally we still feel from the Providence perspective that this bill is not necessary. Providers have the option to obtain the services that it's talked about in this bill through their contracts with us. We worry about the cost of the website specifically, even as it's described in the amendments you have before you. This is a good example, I've been told, of having to spend a lot of money for something that is already available. We're not sure we have the way yet. Some insurers may not, to calculate deductibles and co-insurance on a per-member basis via the web. That's possible in some cases, and some may do that now, but this bill demands it. In addition, I think the private right of action and civil action provisions in this bill are excessive and thus unnecessary, and so if there was a work group convened on that, that's a point we would make again, and for reasons of time, Madam Chair, I'll stop with that and say we appreciate your indulgence in giving us a couple more days to review these and other amendments in the Senate Bill 500 series.
Well, I think it's important for you, for the insurance, to realize that there's a problem here. When you have a practice with 12 surgeons having 2.5 FTE doing nothing but eligibility and prior authorizations, and the average this is from testimony before, when they are spending 127 minutes per patient, there's just a lot of issues that really need to be addressed here. And so I would like still to work with OMA on this bill to address some of your concerns, but Elise, do you want to say something real quick?
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, Elise Brown for America's Health Insurance Plans. And just in closing, I would say that we would appreciate some more time, as both of my AHIP members flanked here have just stated. We appreciate greatly the opportunity to be part of the work group. In fact, AHIP flew in an expert from out of town to help in the discussions around all of the provider bills. So, again, in our mind, we're not there. I think we've made some incremental progress, but we're not there, and we would appreciate some more time.
Well, we gave you enough time. We heard this bill February 26th, and so it's obvious that we're going to have to be making some decisions because you have had enough time. And so I will be needing to talk. If you have amendments that you want to give, I would like to have that done, and if not, then I'll be polling the committee on what we should do with this.
Madam Chair, we're pleased to work on the bill, and I think we appreciate the one work group that we did have, and I was there for a number of hours, not as long as some people, so I don't think you're seeing it from us intransigence. I just think we need to work on this. And at the moment, I do not believe the document in front of you today represents the whatever consensus was achieved a week or so ago. We're still verifying that, by the way, so we're pleased to work with you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. With that, I'll close. And I know I still want to open up the one other, so I'm going to close the public hearing on 506 and open the public hearing on 509. And again, Mr. Shirk, 509.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Senate Bill 509, again, the four bills introduced by the Oregon Medical Association, imposes requirements on certain entities that obtain use of physician discounted rates.
Courtney Dresser and Brian Parrott.
Courtney Dresser, Oregon Medical Association. This is the bill around the silent PPO issue, and that's facing the nation and our state physicians. And in this particular bill, we did ratchet down our proposal quite a bit after our work group meeting, and we looked a lot to the NCOIL model, which is the National Coalition of Insurance Legislators. And that model was worked on for about 2 years with Blue Cross nationally, AMA, AHIP, and the National PPO organization. So we feel we've done our very best to move that bill into more of a consensus model. I'm sure others will disagree. But I think, as you'll see on these two bills and the other two OMA bills, that we are doing our very best to look at the work group, look at the language, and find as many consensus as we can. And I'll let Brian explain the amendments.
Okay. Thank you, Brian Parrott, with the
organization. And I don't think I have a copy of the amendment.
You are correct, because I don't either.
Yeah, Senator Cruz doesn't either, so we must.
I have one copy, but that's not going to help a whole lot.
Yeah, so if you can give that copy. Well, you go ahead and explain it, and then get it to Cassandra, and she'll get the copies to us.
Thank you, Chairman Anderson. Brian Parrott with the Oregon Medical Association. This is the bill that I understand. I was not here for the original, but it's quite confusing how it takes place. And what the Oregon Medical Association was trying to do is say that a PPO could only rent their network panel once, and then it had to stop at that point, and it could not be rented any further than that. The insurance company has indicated that would basically destroy the market, and it was unreasonable. And so we went back in, and we took out all the language that would prevent these panels from being rented multiple times, and we have not placed a limit on it now. They can continue to be rented downstream or passed downstream, leased downstream, however they want to do it. What we did maintain was that there has to be some transparency. There needs to be a website available. There needs to be a way for the doctors or the providers to be able to look and see, okay, where is this, where are my contract obligations being sent? Where are they being sold to? Who else has them? The other piece that we left in was we kept the enforcement pieces in because we feel it's important that if we have a contract with an insurance company and that insurance company decides to sell the contract, that's fine, but our contract is still with the insurance company. If something goes wrong, we need to be able to go back to the person who we have the contract with and say, look, we've been wronged, we need it fixed. And so it maintains the enforcement level with the original contracting entity. We pulled out the enforcement from DCBS because after talking with Teresa Miller, she indicated there would probably be a large financial aspect to them, and we did not want to do that. The only thing that we left in was the registration. She indicated that would not be an issue. They already have a registration process. We did add in language that indicates that if an insurer is already registered as an insurer, they do not have to re-register as a contracting entity. So that would take care of a lot of the registration right there. Also, at the request of the insurance company, we added in a section on continuity of care, and that is language that we copied directly out of the AHIP model, which is also the same as the NCOIL model. There are several models out there. The NCOIL model, as Courtney indicated, has been worked on for several years by several different parties, and so we went back to that one when we looked for language for our amendments.
Thank you. I should state, too, that in drafting this bill, we used
the kind of the covered entities only as physicians. And so we've heard from other healthcare providers who do contracting work with insurance companies that they would like to be included, which makes perfect sense. So I know nurse practitioners have approached you about doing an amendment, and the physical therapist would like to be included. So I think there will be one more amendment that would just broaden what the healthcare providers.
Okay. Thank you very much. And then same panel, Mike Becker, Elise Brown, Dave Fiskum, and Robin Lemire. And since there's another amendment and we need to get to the floor, we will be talking about it again. Here, we got the amendment now, so... And therefore, you'll be able to then take a look at the amendment and come back. So if you don't have much to say, I'd prefer you not to say much.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, Elise Brown again for America's Health Insurance Plans, and I'll follow your cue on that. I am actually going to defer my time here to another AHIP member who was a major participant in the work group. I do want to just say again, as I testified in front of this committee before, that at the national level there has been a lot of work done, as just previously stated by OMA. And that work was done with AHIP and members of NCOIL and AMA. And that process was over a couple of years, and we got to close to a 90% agreement. So there is a piece from NCOIL's model in here now, as well as a piece from AHIP's, but it doesn't go close to addressing some of the concerns that we brought up in the work group. And I'll defer now to another participant.
Okay. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Mike Becker with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 509, and I would just keep my comments to one component of this. And this was brought up in the work group. It's a concern unique to Blue plans, but it involves something called the Blue Card Program, which allows Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon to process claims from other Blue plans where their members are seeking services in Oregon, and then vice versa, where Oregon members are seeking services in any of the other states. And it's this reciprocal relationship that allows us to access the network discounts in those other states and vice versa. Without a specific provision in this bill, it will end the availability for us to use that program with the Blue Cross Blue Shield system. And incidentally, in 2008, that program resulted in over $15 million in savings for our members. But the specific language is very simple. It is a statement that this act does not apply in circumstances where access to the preferred network contract is granted to an entity operating under the same brand license program as the contracting entity. So we have requested that language be included, and it has not been as yet. Thank you.
And we have 2 minutes.
Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chair and the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to be here. I've given you my written testimony, so I'll just really get right to the point. I'm Robin Larmer-Lutke. I'm with First Choice Health. We are an independent, physician-owned, preferred provider organization based in Seattle but operating in this region. We have about 95,000 lives currently in Oregon with a growing presence. In addition to our ownership structure, our greatest asset, frankly, is our physicians and our providers and facilities who make up the provider network that, frankly, is our product. So we're deeply concerned in this legislation, not just it's not just as an industry representative, but also as one who really is concerned about physicians. And we've heard about this NCOIL Model Act, and I guess my main point today is that there has been a great deal of work. Lots of very smart people with a lot of deep industry expertise have done a lot of work at the national level through NCOIL and also in multiple states. I personally have been involved in negotiating and working on these bills in at least 7 different states. And I will tell you that 2 of those states that passed legislation prior to the adoption of the NCOIL model are now going back to their own legislatures looking to get more of what we did with the NCOL model, because frankly we've learned a great deal about the problems that arise with the rental network arrangements and how to fix them over the last couple of years of collaborative, sometimes painful, but typically collaborative and cooperative work. And again, the bill goes much beyond simply network rental arrangements, goes into a lot of contracting items, which are frankly problematic, and I think will cause a lot of a heartburn for a lot of folks. But I really just want to focus on, again, my main point is if we are going to do something to address some of the legitimate concerns providers have with network rental and allowing access to other entities, let's do it in a way that's tried and true, that reflects the expertise of, again, you know, AHIP, AAPPO, AMA, the Blues, and lots of other industry folks, plus the legislators who form up the Health Long-Term Care and Health Retirement Issues Committee of NCOIL. Let's draw on that body of knowledge. Let's not reinvent the wheel. I guess I urge you, if we're going to do something here on network rental, let's consider adopting the NCOIL Model Act as the framework for that legislation. I've attached a copy of the NCOIL model to my testimony for your convenience. I'd be happy to take any questions.
At this point, we can't because we have 2 minutes to get to the floor, but we will take this. I'll be working with the proponents on suggestions to see how we can come to something less onerous to the insurers. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate 509, and we are recessed until 6 o'clock tonight in room E.